Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Well, hello, everyone, and Happy New Year. I can say Happy New Year because I haven't been on the radio in a long, long time. I think it was with Brian right before the New Year, but I haven't been on my own show for a couple months here, and it's nice to be back and good to see Ben, the producer, and see everybody, and Roger.
How you doing? Welcome back.
I'm feeling great. It's like nice to be back in the saddle here. All those sports were preempting me, you know?
Yeah.
It's just I feel unwanted and unneeded.
Oh,
so
we wanted you, we needed you, and especially with what's been going on lately.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Really interesting. And
yeah.
I do want to talk about the Jason Van Dyke case. We talked a little bit about it with Brian in the transition, but I'm going to talk more about it in the 8 o'clock hour. And I'd like to hear from listeners about what they think of the sentence and what they think of the fact that the police officers were acquitted. And I can probably weigh in from my professional standpoint as a practicing lawyer that I wasn't super surprised at either of those things. But I think that I'd like to hear from people, did this take care of the situation? Does this send a message to police officers? Does this send a message that this is not going to be tolerated? Or as I've seen, and you know, you've seen this, Roger,
yeah,
people are threatening to try to vote these judges off the bench because they're so upset about the result. And I'd like to hear what people have to say, and I'd like to do a little explanation, a little deeper explanation of what this sentence really means and what this acquittal means.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have my own thoughts, but, you know, as a news person, I've got to just report on the facts, and that's what the law is, pretty much. I mean, you have to deal with the facts. And sometimes, in some cases, there aren't enough facts, or there's not enough facts in one area as opposed to another area. And I would not want to be a judge. I'll tell you that.
You know what? I wouldn't
Seriously.
Either. I mean, especially there at 26th in California, because you're sending people away for life. You're sending people away that have done terrible things. You're seeing all kinds of people in this world that you sometimes would rather not see, and incidents that will break your heart. But these judges do a very good job. And I'm not saying this as a Pollyanna, because listen, I've done criminal defense work, and I have been angry at judges. I think there have been judges who have done things that are completely wrong, and maybe they use their passion and their prejudice in the wrong way. But for the most part, judges try really hard to get it right. You know, they don't want to do it wrong. They take each case on the facts. They don't think about protesters outside. They don't think about the reverends who are making noise, that this means something for the community, and they don't even listen really to the family members. So much, whether it's on the victim's side or the defendant's side, they are looking at the facts, they're looking at the law, and they're looking at something called reasonable doubt. And I know that people kind of, their eyes glaze over and they go, yeah, right, Karen, reasonable doubt. But it's not a whodunit. It's
right.
Not maybe somebody did it. It's who did it beyond any reasonable doubt. And if there are facts that could go the other way that are plausible, the judge is going to recognize those facts and find that there can't be a conviction. And I'm not going to say anything bad about jurors, but jurors don't parse it quite that same way. Jurors are a little bit more emotional. They see a videotape of 16 shots, and believe me, when you and I have seen that, that's a hard thing to watch. But it's hard to get around that. And I think that a judge really tries hard. And these two judges are very good judges. They've been around collectively, I don't know, 50, 60 years around the courthouse.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, these are good judges. And they did not succumb to pressure. And they tried very hard to look at the facts. And if you saw in the case of Judge Stevenson, the case of the three police officers who were acquitted, you know, she went through all of the facts and
that was
painstakingly
I was surprised at that.
It.
Yeah. I mean, I knew what that was leading up to because of that, or what she did. But my goodness, she did go on covering every specific detail of the case and basically rehashing all of the evidence.
She did. And it's good that she did that, because I think to some extent it explained why she had such a hard time with bringing a conviction. Now, that said, when anybody is charged with a crime, your life is never the same.
Right.
Those three police officers, I mean, take away the emotion of all this. You don't like them. They covered up. You think they're bad. You think they're good. Forget bit about it. They have been charged with a crime. They hired very expensive, very good lawyers. Mm-hmm. Those lawyers could easily have cost $100,000 each. I mean, I don't know, but I do know who they are, and I know that they get excellent results and they work very hard. So, you know, they probably mortgaged their homes. They probably, you know, their names are always going to be tainted. So if you don't think that they've paid for whatever they might have done, they've already paid, even though they're acquitted. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. And I do want to hear from you and the listeners after the 8 o'clock hour. But I want to talk a little bit about what is coming up in my show. In our next segment, I'm going to be talking to a psychologist. Did anybody see Surviving R. Kelly? Surviving R. Kelly is a six segment documentary on Lifetime. Even if you're not interested in R. Kelly or his music, it's just a fascinating documentary because it brings up 50 people or so, who many of them women and young girls who R. Kelly, I will say, befriended and who lived in his house and had sexual relations with him, and talk about abuse, and they talk about sexual abuse, and they talk about the control, and they talk about all of the things that went on with R. Kelly, and interestingly, his career has not suffered. And so it's a very interesting study in the psychology of domestic abuse, sexual pedophilia, and how does someone become this kind of person? What kind of women are attracted and stay and are brainwashed by people like R. Kelly? And why does the community stand by somebody who has had allegations like this for years and years and years? And one of the psychologists who is prominently interviewed in this documentary, Jody Adewale, Dr. Adewale, is a very, very interesting guy. And he's going to come on our show and he's going to explain some of these things again, as he did in the documentary. And again, we're not just talking about R. Kelly, and you don't have to know who he is or like him or like his music or hate his music to get something out of the fact that how do we explain these things. And then we're going to be talking about persuasive speech. So in our daily lives as a lawyer, I am trying to be persuasive. It's very important for me to do that. However, everybody needs to be persuasive, and everybody needs to know how to speak in a way that will help you get what you need, whether it's in a store, in your job, with your boss, whether it's with your spouse, and how to be more persuasive. And we're going to be talking to Dr. Oja Kangas, who has a specialty in this kind of thing and has given speeches to lawyers and a lot of to women who maybe need some help in being a little more persuasive in the way they talk. So I'm going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll be talking to the R. Kelly psychologist. And it's good to be back on the air. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky. I think about it every night and day. Spread my wings and fly away.
Chicago's R. Kelly, celebrated as one of the greatest R&B singers of all time by some, but his playboy lifestyle has been riddled with rumors of abuse, predatory sexual behavior, and underage sex. In 2008, he was acquitted of 14 charges of child pornography in a Chicago courtroom at 26 in California. And as I said before, Surviving R. Kelly is a Lifetime Network documentary that I binge-watched. It was just fascinating to watch. It was very interesting. It was a learning experience. It was hard to watch, but I thought it was important enough to contact the psychologist who was prominently interviewed, Dr. Jody Adewale, who is a licensed psychologist who joins me today on WGN. Hi, doctor.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me. Honored.
Thank you so much for joining me. And I have to say, you did a really good job on this documentary. I know a lot of people who are trained as you are have a hard time explaining things without using big words. And you really kind of use very common words and common explanations that make a lot of sense. And I think you did a very good job on it. So congratulations on that.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's been one of the struggles in the psychology field of bridging the textbook to the community. And I say a lot of people get put off because they don't understand the words that are coming out of a psychiatrist's mouth.
Exactly, and I feel the same way about lawyers. You know, people are put off when lawyers talk in statutes and in concepts that don't make sense. So I'm going to issue a little bit of a disclaimer here because, as you reminded me, there's a rule that says that psychologists can't talk about a particular person if they haven't already interviewed them and if they hadn't gotten consent. So we're going to be talking generally in this regard. We're not going to be talking about R. Kelly. We're going to be talking talking about people who may have some of the same characteristics that are portrayed in the documentary. And again, R. Kelly has not been convicted. That's prominently displayed in the documentary. He's not been charged right now, and he's not been convicted. So let's start with the background of a person who might be capable of pedophilia. What about a person's background would lead a person to have this kind of conduct?
Okay. So before I jump to that question, there's two types. There's a pedophile and a hebephile or hebephile. A pedophile is someone who's more attracted to kids who are 11 and younger. And a hebephile or hebephile is attracted to kids who are between 11 and 14. So it depends. That's just a different clarification to note. Oftentimes people are victimized as young children, and they sometimes get stuck in stages of their sexual and social development. And they understand sex when they were introduced to it. So a person might be sexually abused at 12 and might get stuck in that stage. You don't have to be a victim of sexual trauma or sexual abuse to become a pedophile or hebephile. There might be there might be social factors. There might be biological factors. There might be psychological factors that contribute to your attraction to young boys or young girls. As we develop, there's all types of development that's going on: social, cognitive, emotional, psychological, sexual, moral. And if anything goes wrong in any of these stages of development, it can come out in many ways. So an individual who has been sexually abused sometimes perpetrates the trauma back to children to children where he or she was the same age, but there could be other factors involved, including a learned behavior.
And certainly not everyone who is sexually abused becomes a perpetrator, and I'd make that very clear.
Yes, very clear. So if you were sexually abused, there's a chance that you could perpetrate the violence. If you were sexually abused and you have support from the family, you have psychological support, you maybe are involved with the community, everyone in your environment is telling you this was wrong, you didn't deserve this, yes, you can recover from the trauma. But people who tend to get isolated and have to deal with the abuse on their own sometimes can come out where they re-perpetrate the violence or the sexual abuse to children or adults as they get older.
So that, I guess, that goes to the importance of when it's discovered, and when there is a discovery of this kind of behavior when you're young, you know, to get help for these kids is crucial to kind of cut off the long-term effects that might happen because of it.
Yes, agree. 100% agree. The earlier you can deal with the trauma, the better.
Now, there's an allegation, it's not quite fleshed out in the documentary, but the brother, R. Kelly's brother, said that he was also sexually abused, and I believe he has said outside the documentary that it might have been a sister. And we don't know if that's the case or not, and we're not going to make a claim one way or the other. But this is fairly unusual in that a female family member would sexually abuse a male. Is there some difference between a boy sexually abusing a girl and a girl sexually abusing a boy, or is it all the same when it comes to long-term effects?
So in terms of the effects, I see it as exactly the same. The boys and girls have the exact same reaction to trauma. However, there is societal pressure that influences the reaction. So if a young girl or a young boy is abused by an adult male, oftentimes we see it as negative. Sometimes when a female is abusing a young boy, we don't always see that as a negative. If you see all these teachers, you see some of these middle school teachers, these high school teachers sleeping with 15, 16-year-old boys, and first thing you hear from a lot of people is, oh, that kid, that's great for that kid. But what I've seen is often just as much as young girls are abused by older men, young boys are abused by older women. However, there is a huge amount of silence and shame that young boys don't want to come out and say, because there's a pressure from friends, there's a pressure from even adults. Oh, that was awesome, that's great that you got your first sexual experience with an older woman. It does have the exact same trauma effects as if it were reversed.
Now, and again, you can't comment on the R. Kelly situation, but let's just say that it was true that a little boy at age 10 or 11 was sexually abused by his sister, and now he's kind of going after girls in that 12-year-old range and humiliating them and being dominant and being controlling and being sexual with them. Is that an explanation? Is that, can you explain it by saying that, you know, he was perhaps controlled and abused and maybe humiliated by the sister, and now he's turning that around and doing that against people who he's likening to his sister? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's definitely a good theory. There's a defense mechanism, many defense mechanisms you and I have, every human being has them as a way of protecting themselves. And you'll see this with victims of trauma and even the kids who are bullied. It's something called identification, where you identify with the person who is hurting you or sexually abusing you. It's a way to protect yourself from further victimization. So a person, say I'm a child being bullied at school, I become a bully, the bully sees me as a bully, so we link up. A person who might be sexually abused as an early child might psychologically identify with their perpetrator as a way of protecting his or her ego and, in a sense, being the perpetrator, that taking out those actions on younger kids as a way of identifying with the perpetrator. It's a way we protect ourselves from psychological distress.
Before we take a break, let's add to the mix, you know, this is an unusual situation because we have money and fame, and we've seen this with Michael Jackson, and we've seen this with other people who are around a lot of money that came really fast and fame that came very fast. And R. Kelly, in his situation, he was a person who was maybe shy and withdrawn. He had trouble reading. Music was his outlet. He was obviously very talented right from the beginning. And so he got all of this attention, the good, positive attention right away. How does that add to the mix? How is a person who maybe had these horrible things happen to them in their family life, then have all these wonderful things happen, how does that mix play out in terms of later conduct?
Yeah, so what's important to know is we're all human beings. We breathe the same air, we eat the same food, we use the same toilets. A person who all of a sudden has the world has become on a pedestal, the world puts them on the pedestal, it's possible that they might feel that they can do no wrong, or their behavior can be justified, and or they're protected by so many people, lawyers, family members,
right,
their entourage.
Yes, man.
So So essentially, behavior isn't corrected. If you and I do something, the police are going to correct this right away. Our parents are going to correct this. Our friends, our neighbors, they say, what the hell are you doing? However, when you have so much power that's gained so quickly, it's hard to get that real, unbiased correction where you could do something completely wrong and no one says anything, and you learn this must not be wrong because I haven't had a consequence.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We have Dr. Jody Adewale, who's a psychologist, talking a little bit about issues that were raised by the R. Kelly documentary, Surviving R. Kelly. Please stay tuned. We're going to go to news in a little bit, and then we're going to talk a little bit more on the other side. You're listening to WGN. About Surviving R. Kelly. We're talking about that documentary that's on Lifetime. It was just a fascinating documentary about a lot of issues. And Dr. Jody Adewale, who was prominently interviewed on that show, is with us from sunny Pasadena, California, married to a lawyer, I might add. I'd love to hear the arguments between the two of you. That would be very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah. They go nowhere. It's all about emotions with me. It's all about logic with her.
Oh, there you go. There you go. You're going nowhere. Okay. Let's switch topics a little bit. And we were focusing on the sexual abuser. And let's talk about the victims of sexual abuse, domestic violence, and sort of the brainwashing that was alleged in this documentary. The allegations were that these girls were very young. A lot of them wanted to be stars. They were talented. They could sing. And R. Kelly approached them and said, I can make you a star. And all of a sudden, the girls are separated from their families and are in these humiliating and abusive relationships. So again, you can't comment on that because you don't know the players and you haven't interviewed anyone. But in a situation where you have domestic abuse and you have this separation from families, how are there certain women, are there certain victim types that a perpetrator would seek out in this situation?
Yes, I do believe so. There's something called the foot in the door phenomenon, where small requests lead to larger requests. This is a very simple social psychology theory. And if you ask someone to do something small, they're more likely to give in as the requests get larger and larger. So something like call me daddy might seem like a small request, but a perpetrator might be looking at their individual. Oh, if he or she is willing to do that, that's a sign I can keep moving and I can increase the amounts of requests that I have to lead to, in a sense, sexual or physical abuse. Pedophiles, hebephiles often look at young kids or young teenagers who might be alone or whose family might not be present, or who the perpetrator has something they can exploit the child with, a singing career, money, food, a house, a place to live, maybe an acting career. So oftentimes perpetrators can look for people who they can exploit by either giving them something, promise something, or providing the emotional support that they might not be getting from family or from society.
And it was interesting because I didn't sense, and again, you don't know the whole story, but I didn't sense it in this documentary that these girls came from really bad families. In fact, the family members were present and they were, you know, in large part, you know, involved in some of these things, and then certainly were upset when their daughter was kind of taken away from them. So it's not always kids who are runaways. It's not always kids who have bad relationships, but that probably would help, I would imagine.
Yes, yes. And from the documentary, I saw a lot of these families are present with loving and caring.
Yes.
So in a sense, I do see it potentially could have been the promise of a dream, the promise of a career, the promise of I'm going to fulfill all your dreams. And that can be just as enticing as emotional support for someone who lacks it.
So the allegations are that there was dominance, and, you know, the girls couldn't go to the bathroom without asking. The girls couldn't eat anything without asking. The girls couldn't use their cell phones. The girls couldn't leave their room. And there was humiliation. And I don't need to go into the details of that, and I'm not sure I know all the details. But where does a relationship, where does that domination, that desire to dominate to the point of almost a ridiculous situation, and where does the desire to humiliate come from?
Mm-hmm. So much like sex, it can be a drug. Sex can be just as addicting as crack or heroin or alcohol. There's Sex Addicts Anonymous. And we find, just like crack or just like heroin, you need more and more of the drug as time progresses to get the same effect. With sex, sometimes normal, just regular sex doesn't do it for you. But you need to step up the game and do something more wild and more wild and more wild to feed this insatiable craving that one might have. So normal, regular sex might still go for a while, and then humiliation might be the itch that scratches the desire. So just like drugs, sex can be just as addicting, and you need more and more and more risky behavior to feel that drive, to feed that drive of sex or exploitation.
And just for people who are online dating, and I know a lot of people, that's the way you meet people these days, apparently. Mm-hmm. And I know that I've seen situations, you know, doing domestic violence work in the courts myself, that sometimes they meet people online and they don't see the red flags. For people out there who are online dating, are there any red flags for people, and I'll say men, women can be abusive as well, but that might have the tendency to bring someone in and in a relationship and then become dominant and become abusive physically, sexually, emotionally? What are the warning signs, if you have any?
So it's really hard because people who perpetrate this type of behavior know that victims don't want to be hurt. So they have to, in a sense, be very charismatic and kind and sweet and loving at the beginning. It's almost like attracting a squirrel to you. You can't make any big movements because that squirrel's going to run away. You have to be loving and sweet. Once you're in a relationship, it's important to watch out if an individual wants to isolate you. If he or she wants to put you on an island, a metaphorical island, taking away your phone, limiting your contacts, having complete control over the finances, not letting you watch TV, decreasing your social media, access, that's a warning sign. He or she wants to put you on an island, because once that island is established, the abuse is much easier to perpetrate. Someone who might be emotionally unstable, where they get angry really fast or show outbursts of violence, that might be another huge warning sign. Another warning sign is a history of domestic violence. If someone has a history of domestic violence or sexual abuse in their past, it's possible that that can be a predictor of future behavior. I know people don't always have a psych profile or the records of an individual, but it might be good to find out more about this person than just from what they say.
And remember, a lot of the records, if you're listening out there, court records, a lot of them are public. And if you don't know how to go about getting them, you might want to hire a private investigator to look into it. And it sounds ridiculous, but if you're involving yourself with someone who you don't know very well, that might be a good predictor. Even reading their divorce paperwork, because a lot of times, again, a lot of times people allege things that are false in order to get an advantage in divorce. So you can't believe everything you read, but you certainly can get some an idea if that might be an issue. So that's a little word to the wise there. So, you know, Dr. Adewale, I think the final issue that I want to talk about is the issue of, here's a guy who has had these allegations swirling around him, and now it's finally coming to roost. We just had our Springfield, fairgrounds deny R. Kelly a permit to perform there. They're citing security issues. I really think they don't want the unpopularity of the situation. But it's now just coming to roost where people are signing petitions and trying to boycott and trying to get Sony to back off of his contract and the like. But up until now, there have been no ramifications for him, really. How do you explain, and, you know, in the African-American community, if he's doing this to the African-American girls, because there's really no evidence he's really going into the to white girls. It's mostly black girls, young black girls, mm-hmm. who you know, why hasn't the community been up in arms against him?
So there's many explanations for this. I can give two just offhand. In the African-American community, there's a sense that many men have been attacked by sort of organizations, by police, by other races. And so there might be a tendency to initially want to protect, an instinct to protect is what I call. So Carl Jung, a famous psychiatrist, talked about the collective unconscious, meaning we all share a sort of a way we think. And when men have been attacked, African-American men have been attacked so much in the history, there might be an instinctive response from the African-American community to defend this individual, regardless of the data, just because he the man, or the metaphorical man, has been attacked by all these systems. So another concept could be, our mind is broken down into two parts, the rational side and the emotional side. When an individual has appealed to the emotional side of your mind for years and decades, it's hard for the rational part of your mind to have any weight against all that data that's in the emotional side. All these songs, all this music has given us a perception of who the person is. And when data and facts comes out, it's hard to rationalize when there's so much information in our emotional mind. Now that this information is coming out, it's on television, and the whole country, almost the whole planet is talking about it, people are able to now more rationalize that this behavior is true. If they can do that, it will bring them out of a state of denial.
Interesting. And I do sense that the tide has turned, and there's going to be some ramifications. And my prediction is that our state's attorney here in Cook County may try to bring some charges if she possibly can. She's already sent out feelers to potential victims. So we're going to be watching this very, very carefully. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Adewale, you are an author. You're many things. You're an NFL football player. You're a psychologist. You wrote some books, Perceptions of Fatherlessness and Absent Fathers. But the one I'm interested in is, Who Can Curly Trust? Can you tell our listeners very briefly what that book is and where they can buy it?
Yes, you get it on Amazon. It's a kid's book for basic parents or therapists, teaching kids what therapy is and what confidentiality is, how important it is to seek someone you can support, who you can trust to talk about your pain or what sort of secrets and things that have been hurting you throughout your life or through your childhood. It's a very interesting children's book.
And whether that's bullying or sexual abuse or abuse of any kind, mm-hmm. and encouraging children to open up, because that's the start of the cure then.
Yes, exactly.
Dr. Jody Adewale, thank you so much for joining us, and have a great evening and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, Ken. Keep up the great work.
Okay. You take care. Bye-bye. All right. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Karen Conti Show. I'm a practicing lawyer, but we talk about all kinds of other things. And what we're going to do tonight is I have another guest, and we're going to have a great conversation. And then about 8:15, we are going to be taking your calls on any topic at all. If you want to talk about a legal topic, a legal question you might have about divorce, everyone gets divorced in January. It's the date. It's the month for divorces. Even the Amazon CEO is getting divorced. We can talk about that. Or if you want to talk about the Jason Van Dyke sentence or anything in the news that is of interest to you, you'll be taking those calls at 8:15. The number is 312-981-7200, 981-7200, and you can also text to that very same number. Speaking persuasively is very, very important in every aspect of your life, whether you're a lawyer or whether you're a stay-at-home mom, whatever it is. When you're trying to convince your children, you can convince your spouse or your boss that you need a raise, you need to be persuasive in the way you speak. And we have on a guest who is concentrates in the issue of speech and how to better be persuasive and how to better be understood, Dr. Catherine Ojakangas is here to discuss this. Hi, doctor. How are you?
Hi. Thank you so much. I'm fine.
I'm kind of nervous because now I'm kind of thinking about how I'm saying things, so I'm getting nervous here.
You have great speech.
But, you know, again, it is something that you don't pay attention to, but when you do pay attention, you can make yourself so much more effective when you do some certain little things. And I know a little bit about it, but you know a lot about it. So let's talk about what are the components of being a good persuasive speaker. What do people find convincing when they listen to somebody?
Well, first of all, you need to really know who your listener is, who you're trying to convince. It's much different if you're trying to convince your boss of something. It depends on your boss's personality versus your husband or your child, right? Certain people will listen to certain things. So part of it is goes along with how the listener is and what their strengths, what will convince them is the first part. And you need to really be aware of that. There is a nice model that I've sometimes used with people that deals with how expressive you are versus unexpressive and how assertive you are or unassertive. So if your husband likes to tell people things and doesn't like to listen, perhaps, and doesn't like to talk about feelings, then to persuade that type of person, you might want to use facts rather than emotions. Whereas if the opposite end of the spectrum in this model is a very considerate person who really wants to express feelings, wants to understand your feelings. So that type of person, you would use a totally different argument with.
So this takes some planning. If you're getting ready to try to persuade someone, you shouldn't just from the gut start out. You should really think about what you're doing and what you're saying.
That's right. Yeah. People's communication personalities are very good to know. It's very good to know your own as well as those around you, the people that are important around you in work or at home. That will influence
one of the interesting things. I know you just gave a speech to some lawyers for a group, and I actually sent my associate to your seminar because I thought she could use some help. Not that she's bad, she's a young lawyer, but I do know that women are perceived differently, and I know that when I argue in court, I get treated differently. I get interrupted more than men. I know that judges will try to say things like calm down or slow down, and when the man is doing the same thing, he doesn't get that. So what are some of the differences in how men and women are perceived when they speak?
Well, I think that it has to do with two aspects. One is historical. Unfortunately for women, it's been kind of a man's world in the past. And men, especially like in law, in your profession, it's really been only really fairly recently that women have been able to enter that profession as well as become judges, etc. So men have historically had more power And that's changing, but changing very slowly. Another component to this is anatomical. Men are larger generally. Again, I'm talking just in stereotypes here. And they have a larger body and therefore larger vocal folds. And we equate power with a lower voice and less power with a higher voice. And that is just, there are these givens. Now, that is... the way things are, and the hopefully they're changing with women becoming more and more equal to men, but our voices on the whole, on the average, will never be as low as men, and we need to do other things to make sure that we're heard and not do other certain things that you might want to talk about.
I mean,
later.
What if you can't, you know, and I know a lot of women have a high-pitched voice, and you hear them on the phone, and they sound like little children, you know? How, you can't change the pitch of your voice, can you?
It depends. If that person, there are a lot of people who are using the wrong pitch for their voice. Now, your vocal cords are right, you know, in your throat, and if you say, ah, and put your hand there, you can feel them vibrating, and they're of a certain size. So some women have just become very used to, as well as some men, but some people have become very used to using the wrong pitch, too high of a pitch. You've heard some people on television, I know, on sitcoms, where they use, there's some really funny high voices in some comedies of certain characters, and I wonder, you know, this is not really how they're supposed to talk.
Right.
This is not just a normal voice. So everybody has an optimal pitch, the pitch that their body is meant to use, and around which we vary our pitch to express emotion.
When we come back, I've got to take a break here, but when we come back, I'm going to talk about my two pet peeves in life, and one is upspeak. Mm-hmm. And one is this growl talk. I call it growl talk. I think you call it vocal fry that the Kardashians and the Katy Perrys of the world use. And we're going to play those, and we're going to talk about why they've become prevalent in society and why you should never talk like them. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We're here with Dr. Catherine Ojikangas. After the 8:15 break, we will be taking your questions, legal calls, or any comments you have about the news that you've seen and heard this week. I'm happy to try to answer or weigh in. That number here is 312-981-7200. Text to that same number if you have a question for our guest. Right now, we're talking to Dr. Catherine Ojikangas, who is a speech pathologist, and she is a person who's going to talk to us about how to be more persuasive. Welcome back, doctor.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk about my two pet peeves. One, we're going to talk about upspeak, and Ben, my producer, is going to play a little segment, and I think we all know what upspeak is, but if you don't know what upspeak is, listen to it now.
Is the book doing well, John?
Well, it's been out for 2 weeks now, and it's already in its second printing.
Uh-huh. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Well, you know how people want to know things, but they never find out?
Yes.
And all they have to do is ask more questions?
Yes.
Because most people are just afraid to ask?
Right.
So, well, I show you how to make everything you say a question,
uh-huh.
So people have to answer them?
Uh-huh. Isn't that a little annoying?
Well, see how you did that? How
Isn't
you
that
came
a little
right
annoying?
Out and you asked me?
Yeah.
See how that works?
Uh-huh.
Because
okay, so obviously the upspeak is where you kind of make everything into a question, even if it's not a question. Do we know where this came from and why we have this kind of epidemic in our speech patterns?
The most prevalent theory is that it arose in Southern California, in San Fernando Valley, with Valley Girl Speak. I don't really know if that's true because it's gone all over the country so much and spread so widely. But I think that maybe with television, et cetera, it has really started, took off that way, and people are, social creatures we are. We like to copy our friends. And I think that much of all the vocal habits that start are prevalent now have just come about a lot of times by copying our friends and wanting to be a part of the social group that they're in. And, you know, down south, some of us go down south to visit relatives if we're from there, and we start using a southern accent. Right. Or I go up to northern Minnesota and I can start saying boat and house and things like that.
Right, right. So what does it do? I mean, to me, when I hear young lawyers doing that, you know, judge, I brought this motion for summary judgment, and my best argument is, and I just think it just detracts from your authority, right?
Totally. And there's a lot of research that shows that people will, and especially if you're interviewing for a job, et cetera, as well, you are thought of as less competent, less educated, less trustworthy. You're just, you know, less attractive. It's
wow.
not a good way to speak at all. What we should do is whenever there is a period, we bring our voice down. So this is the Karen Conti show. I don't say this is the Karen Conti show. If I put my voice up, it sounds like more is coming. Bringing your voice up for upspeak is more like a comma. I'm going to buy oranges, apples, and grapefruit. Then I go down at the end because okay. there's a period. So that's kind of a good rule to use.
And I think a lot of people probably don't even know that they do it. I remember I was correcting a student that I have. I teach law school, and she was using upspeak to the judge in a motion practice that we had, and she had no idea what I was talking about. And I really thought it would have been a great exercise to record her so she could hear how it sounded and how it would yes. sound if she did it the right way and how different it was right. and how authoritative it might have been. So, but do you recommend that? I mean, you counsel a lot of people in different things, and we'll talk about you counsel people who have accents, correct?
That a lot of times, okay, yes, international professionals who have accents.
So you have to have them listen to how they sound, and then you have mm-hmm. to critique them and have to have them listen to the correct way to do it, right?
Right.
And that's probably a really good thing to do, even though none of us really likes to listen to our voice.
It's very hard to do that, and nobody thinks that they sound good at first. And it takes a lot of practice. It takes 3 to 4 months of practicing a certain type of new habit religiously before you can actually make it a habit and not think of it anymore. You don't want to think about how you speak. You want to think about what you're saying.
Of course, of course. And it's a lot to think about mm-hmm. to do all of those things, especially if you're speaking to a group. You know, where you want to look good, you want to sound good, you want to say the right thing, you want to listen to questions. It really entails a lot of brain work, and sometimes the way you speak falls to last category.
Yes, exactly.
Let's talk about this. I call it growl talk. You call it, what is it?
Glottal fry or vocal fry.
Okay. Ben, why don't you play this? And this is a montage of Kim Kardashian talking in multiple scenarios.
And out a little bit. Green for time. You. Now, poverty. Doing. You might like that one. Out my lip on the outfit. And hated what you want and what you get. Interesting. Naked. Take selfies. You guys do. About it. Time. Exact. No. Line. Decade ago.
Oh, turn it off, together. Please. Oh, my gosh. And Britney Spears does it. Katy Perry does a little bit. You'll hear it. Now that you've heard this, you'll notice there are a lot of young, more women, I think. Do this than the boys, but where does this come from? Why are we talking like this?
Well, and again, theories is all I can bring forward here. If we are, especially with women, if power is given off by a lower voice and we don't have a lower voice, we might try to speak with a lower voice. And so, what glottal fry is using too low of a pitch. Using our voices too low, not upspeak too high, but too low. So we can all try to do that. Can you do that now, Karen?
I can talk like this. I don't know.
And it becomes a habit. I'm sure Kim Kardashian isn't trying to do that. It's her habitual way of speaking now. And it also is used by people who kind of want to sound like they're not that interested, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. and again, it's really distracting mm-hmm. from the listener's standpoint, especially when you're older. And, you know, I'm just not used to hearing that kind of talk. And so when I hear it, I really, again, I make those assumptions that you just noted, that someone's not educated or someone is unsure of themselves or they want my approval, especially the upspeak. Mm-hmm. They're asking me to just nod my head and say, yes, you're right. Yeah, that is your name. Instead of listening to what they're saying.
And also, glottal fry is also very unhealthy. It's not good for your vocal folds. You can actually get vocal nodules and things. So it's using too low of a pitch. You should use the pitch that you're meant to use.
let's just say that a lot of people have children who have to give speeches in school, or maybe you're going to church, or you're giving a eulogy, or you're giving a talk to your workplace. You're preparing for a speech. You're helping your child prepare for a speech. What are the bullet points of what you should do to sound the best you possibly can sound?
Well, first of all, you need to practice. Everybody, whenever they first start to practice their speech, sound horrible. It always sucks at first. That's just normal, no matter, you know, whatever you do. Secondly, there's a really good way to think of that nervous energy. If you imagine public speaking, giving your talk as the worst possible thing you can think of, instead, feel that energy and think, I'm excited. This is a challenge. This will be fun. And that really helps. If you can keep thinking that, it will help you get over that hump. Also, remembering that it's not about you, especially maybe for a eulogy. You know, you're trying to tell about this person. It's not about you. It's about helping other people understand a concept. If you're explaining some project or giving some kind of presentation, you're the messenger. And they're not sitting and judging you. They are trying to get the information. And if you think like that and think, oh, if I can help just one person, then that usually helps to quell the nerves. But practice is really important, so you know what you're doing. You're meant to be nervous if you don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, that's exactly true. And I do like your comment about energy, because I hear speakers that may not be the best, most grammatical, most whatever, but they have energy and they are excited about what they're saying, and they get people involved and they're listening, and it's contagious. Then you're energetic, and then you're listening energetically, if there's such a thing, and that's all good.
And I'd like to say one other thing. You're supposed to be, when you're giving a talk, it's good to be the best you. You don't have to be like a perfect public speaker. Just be you, exemplified, you know, exaggerated a little bit and have fun and just be you. Don't think about perfection. Think about connecting with the audience.
Very good advice. And Dr. Ojakangas does, just briefly about your business, where you counsel people who may have an accent who English may not be the first language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. I have a little business called Accent-American. It's online. You can find it. And I work mainly with international professionals from corporations, companies, lawyers, etc. People who speak English fluently are from some other country and are working here. I sometimes work with people as well overseas, and we just do it online, but help them to communicate more effectively in American English.
Okay, sounds good. And what's the email address or website you can get?
The website is www.accent-american.com. And my email is DRO for Dr. O at accent-american.com.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Have a happy new year.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your legal calls on any legal topic or news that you want to discuss. I'm open here, 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
You can put away your tissues, because here's the answer to your legal issues. 30 years experience in this town. Karen Conti wears the legal crown, and it's about to go down.
That was a rap done by one of my clients. He did a rap for me. It was really nice. That was very nice. Bob Garden, he's the greatest. And so this is the time you can call in with your legal questions. Any legal question you might have about anything that floats your boat, I'm happy to weigh in on it. I've kind of covered a lot of different legal topics over the years, and I've handled a lot of different kinds of cases, some criminal cases and commercial cases. I do a lot of litigation. I do family law. And even though I don't practice in every single area, I know a little bit and can maybe guide you in the right direction. So the number here is 312-981-7200. Text to that same number, 981-7200. You'll get Ben, my producer, and he will take your the facts of your case and try to be succinct and try to tell us quickly what your issue is and what it is you want to know and what it is you want to know. And while the phone lines are coming in right now, that's great. I can't wait to get to them. I just wanted to say this. As you know, I take calls at my office and I take emails at my office. And I refer people to lawyers in the areas where I don't practice. So, for instance, I don't practice in the area of personal injury or workers' comp or bankruptcy or things like that. But I know lawyers in those areas, and they're trusted people, people who I know and I know do a good job and that are well-priced. And sometimes I can even refer you to somebody in your area, Northwest suburbs, not always, but sometimes I can get you somebody who might be closer and more convenient for you. But one of the things that I noticed, and I was keeping track this past year of all the people that had cases that I referred, and I was keeping track of how much money they received in settlements and in verdicts this year alone, 2018, last year alone, and it came to almost $6 million. So these are cases that I did not try or I did not settle, but cases that I referred to other lawyers in the area of personal injury, commercial litigation, workers' compensation, employment discrimination. And so I kept track of how much money came in for my clients that I referred, and that was the amount. And I'm very, very happy about that because I was able to get people the help that they needed. And it's good for me. It's good for business. It's good for my reputation. But mostly I really enjoy getting you the right lawyer because there's some lawyers out there who may advertise or may be on the websites that pop up right away, who may not be the best lawyers. And so it makes me feel, it feels like I'm doing a good public service by getting you the right person for your situation. All right, let's go to the lines 981-7200. Let's go to Donald. Hi, Donald. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Longtime fan. I've listened to you for years, and I really enjoy your show on WGN here. And
thank you.
Yeah.
So
I'm wondering about kind of a national thing we've seen in the last few years. These federal judges kind of voiding out executive orders, and whether you're on one side or the other, I find it really disconcerting because I worry about the stability of our country. When a president issues an executive order, another president comes in, uses executive order to get rid of that, which seems to me completely legal, and then a federal judge somewhere decides that that's unconstitutional. I mean, I don't understand how that can be. And whether you're on one side of the political spectrum or the other, I think if one president, if a bunch of courts do that, this sets precedent for the other side of the spectrum doing that in another administration. And the stability of the country is really my concern when we start doing stuff like this.
You know, I totally agree with you, Donald, because, and you see this in all realms of politics now. Now, even just the idea that someone is nominated for a Supreme Court position or a cabinet position or whatever it is that's being confirmed, you see that it's all about politics now. And you see that it's not about the merit of the person. It's more about, you know, striking someone down because the other side did the same thing to them last time they had a candidate. So you're seeing this retaliation, and you're seeing this kind of politicizing of everything. Now, the executive orders are very interesting because executive orders really aren't the way that, in my view, changes are supposed to be made. And I have seen... I've seen both sides do it. Barack Obama was frustrated and he issued some executive orders to get around some of the stalemates regarding immigration, whether you like what he did or not. He used executive orders, and I think some of them were stricken down. And Donald Trump is using executive orders when he doesn't like what's going on. And it's not a good way to conduct business, because what you want is you don't want the executive branch to be legislating and coming up with things that aren't approved by the Congress. And the frustration levels must be high and all of that. But that's just not the way it should work. And I agree with you. When you have an executive order and then you undo it with the next president, we have this idea that nothing is permanent and nothing has any merit. And that gives people a real lack of confidence, I think, in the system. And I think that's what I hear you saying, right?
Yes, exactly what I'm saying. But I don't. So it's going to get to the point where I think somebody, another judge in another district, say, you know, the Ninth District does something they don't like it, the travel ban, blah, 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 from Hawaii and California. And then I think in the future, somebody like, the 5th District is going to go, well, we're going to supersede that federal judge. We're going to say that his, you know, and I just think it's going to be like tic-tac-toe where nobody can possibly win. And I just worry about things spiraling out of control because I've read Jefferson, I've read the Founding Fathers, and they say when we start doing stuff that's not in the Constitution, we start ruling by judiciary, things will really spin out of control quickly.
Thank you for the call, Donald. You know, thank you. I think that that he makes some really good points here, but the judicial branch is just a little bit different because the different districts can disagree on what the law is, and ultimately the Supreme Court picks that up and decides it. And usually, what the Supreme Court rules stays what the Supreme Court rules, unless there's a huge difference and a huge change in the makeup. But let's go to a break. We're getting lots of good legal questions. I'm going to try to get to all of you. So hold on. 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show.
K to the A, R to the E, N. Karen. She's the pop. Conti. K to the A, R to the E, N.
And we go a little something like this. Hit it.
Criminal investigation. Legal interpretation. Swindle of the elderly. Mistaken identity. Second chances. Unwanted advances. Coworker flirtation. HR violation. Wrongful termination. Legal consultation.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. Taking your calls on any legal topic. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Joel. Hi, Joel. Welcome to WGN.
Hello, how you doing? It's amazing to talk to you, first-time caller, new listener.
Welcome. Happy New Year. What's your question?
Thank you. It could be hours of conversation. I pro se when I go to court on traffic tickets because I'm not a driver under Bouvier's legal law dictionary stating that a driver is one that uses a highway and roads for carrying cartage or persons. I'm just a traveler, common law. And had a case that defended that they wrote me two tickets for obstructing a peace officer. My hands were on the wheel, and he's telling me, asking me for things, and I'm telling him I'm a traveler.
Okay, hold on one second. So do you have a driver's license?
I had at one time.
Okay, but you don't. So how are you traveling without a driver's license?
Under the Constitution, it's my right to travel.
So are you driving a car without a driver's license?
Correct.
Okay.
No driving, I'm traveling.
Okay.
With my own personal property.
Now, you have a point, and this is a very academic kind of point, but you have a right to travel as a citizen, as a person in this country. You have a right to travel anywhere you want. You have a right to go, and you can't have that taken away from you because that's the right of liberty under, I guess it's the Fifth Amendment. But you can't drive unless, because that's a privilege, unless you have a driver's license in most states. You are required to have one. So what you're trying to say, Joel, is that the necessity to have a driver's license doesn't apply to you because you can travel without one. But I don't think that's going to fly anywhere, and that's a real dangerous thing to do because you're going to end up in jail.
I've pissed them off a little bit, and they've done that too. But I mean, with U.S. Supreme Court cases like Thompson versus Shapiro and Chicago Motor Coach versus Chicago.
Well, we're not going to quote. You know what? Yeah. We're not going to quote cases just because that's too
right.
It's too complicated.
But even Bouvier's legal law dictionary states that I can travel unencumbered on any highway or thoroughfare, public access. Whether it's car, motorcycle, motor coach, et cetera. I mean, it's just like the Amish. They don't have a license to run a carriage and a horse.
Right. You know what? I'm going to go to the next call. But thank you so much for your call. It's an interesting concept, and it's one of those things that people make a big deal of. It's much like, you know, do I have to pay taxes? It's against my religion or something. You can make all those arguments, and you know what? They might have merit from a technical and educational standpoint. But in the bottom line is, if you're getting in your car without a driver's license and you are caught, you will be arrested and you will not be pretty. So you can assert all of those academic arguments. And Joel, I applaud you. You sound like you've done your homework and you've looked up the cases. But I'll tell you, no judge is going to really listen to that and really rule in your favor. So but it's interesting. You're absolutely right. Everyone has a right to travel. And that might mean you can walk along public highways. That might mean, you know, you can ride your bicycle. Certainly you can ride as a passenger, but driving a car without a license is going to get you in trouble. All right, here we go. Let's go to Jenny. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Hi.
Hi. Here's my question. A patient goes to a doctor with a particular illness, and the doctor prescribes a medication that he knows is not going to work. Is that illegal?
And why do you think the doctor prescribed something that wasn't going to work?
Well, a lot of times people go to the doctor with flu if the flu symptoms have persisted. And flu is a viral infection. And doctors will prescribe antibiotics, which I understand are good for bacterial infections, but not for viral infections. And if that's true, then of all the people who ought to know this, a doctor ought to.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to give you my best answer. Is it illegal? Is it illegal, like, could a doctor be arrested for that? Probably not. The doctor probably has some reason to do that, I would imagine. I understand your situation here. Your situation is one is viral and one is bacterial, and obviously, antibiotics don't deal with viral, and so why would they be giving you that? And generally, it's not good to take these kinds of things if they're not going to work, because you might develop some sort of resistance to it. And then when you really do need something like that, like penicillin or whatever, amoxicillin, that it won't be effective for your situation. Is it malpractice to do that? You know, it might be. Would that, so the way you analyze it is, does that deviate from the standard of care of a good doctor to do that? Meaning, would a good doctor prescribe something that doesn't work? And the answer might be that it is malpractice. But the question is, are you going to sue over it? And will there be a lawyer out there who will bring a lawsuit based upon getting a prescription for something that either you didn't take or that you took and it didn't work? Just not a lot of damages there. In order to sue a doctor, you're going to need a lot of damages, like something really bad happened to you, like you got sick or you went into a coma or you got very sick and you almost died and you had long-term problems. Just because suing doctors is very difficult. And it's very expensive, and there are certain requirements that make you, as a lawyer, file certain affidavits that attest to the malpractice. So it's very complicated. So the question is it wrong? Probably it's wrong, because why would a doctor do that? Like, I wouldn't, as a lawyer, tell you to file a motion or do something or file a lawsuit that didn't have merit. That would be wrong for me to do that. But is someone going to bring a lawsuit, and is it going to be worth someone's time to pursue it? Probably not. So let's go to, are we ready for Judy? Yes, no? Judy. Hi, Judy. Welcome to WGN. Nope. Judy? Nope. All right. So I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about January being the month that more people file for divorce. And every year it happens where people file for divorce. And it was interesting. We saw Jeff Bezos, the founder and chief executive of Amazon, announce that he and his wife, Mackenzie, are getting a divorce after 25 years. A lot of people were asking me, first of all, did he deliver the subpoena in an overnight Amazon package? I don't think so. And do you just say, Alexa, I want a divorce? No. I think it's interesting that that Jeff Bezos filed for divorce, and I hear the questions that people ask me. Will she get half of it? What if she didn't do anything to help earn it? And that's sort of not the way divorces work. And that's one kind of misperception I would like to dispel. Mackenzie was, she was a graduate of Princeton. I guess she writes fiction. She raised the family's four children. children. They live in Washington State. He's worth about $137 billion, which might make this the most lucrative or the most the biggest monetary divorce ever in the history of the country. But that's not the question. The question is, you know, what is she entitled to? And the issue is, if you're married and money is acquired during the marriage, generally speaking, both spouses have shared in the making of that money, meaning he couldn't have made all that money if she didn't stay at home with those kids and raise them. She was a partner in the marriage, and she's entitled to 50% right from the get-go. Unless the law is different in Washington than it is anywhere else, she doesn't have to prove what she did. It's marital money, which means picture it like a barrel. Whenever you get married, whatever you had before, if you keep it separate and keep it in your own name, you can walk away with that at the end of the marriage. But anything that's acquired during the marriage, whether that's a car, whether that's a bank account, whether that's a pension, whether that's a 401k, whether that's a company that you started, all of that goes into the marital barrel, and it gets divided up when the parties divorce. And that's regardless of fault, whether he's cheating or she's cheating. The marriage is going to probably be a 50-50 split, give or take. And there might be a few percentage points one way or the other, depending upon how the judge looks at what the equities are here. So again, just remember that when people stay married, I get a lot of people, they've been married for 10 years, but they've been separated for 5 years. And they think that, you know, all the pension that they're making and this 401k that they're putting away in their savings account in the last 5 years are yours. No, you will have to share it with your spouse when you get a divorce. So the bottom line is, if you are going to get a divorce and you think you're going to get a divorce, you should do it as soon as possible. Otherwise, the assets that you're acquiring on an ongoing basis all go into that marital barrel that will be divided up at the end of the day. In any event, give me a call. I've got 15 more minutes here to answer your legal questions. 981-7200, 981-7200. And if you don't get in touch with me now, you can always call me at my office, 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. I'm taking your legal calls, 981-7200. And why don't we get a caller? I'm going to do a news trivia quiz, okay? News trivia quiz for valuable prizes if we get to it. So I want to answer legal questions first. Let us go to Judy. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Yes, hi, Karen. I'll try to make this a quick question. There's a lot of history behind it, but we don't have time. My ex had put a 6-month order of protection. It was basically a harassment. She only did it for 6 months, and it was dropped. He went back and apparently got a 2-year one. I never got served the papers. I never got anything from the court to show up. I only know about it through family members. Is there anything I can do about that?
Yes. Generally speaking, a person can go into court and get an order of protection ex parte, which means without you being there. But almost immediately, the police department will serve you with that, and you will have a right to go in and contest it within usually a certain number of days, a couple of weeks. So you have a right to a full trial and due process to contest that order of protection. I don't know why when they issued the first order of protection, they didn't give you notice of that, because they're usually very good and very careful at doing that. If you can prove that you didn't get notice of that and he went in and got the full order, 2-year order of protection, you can move to vacate it. So you'd have to file paperwork to do that. Generally speaking, it's easier with a lawyer, but you can go to the clerk's office of the county where it was issued and file a motion to vacate and prove that you were never served with the paperwork and therefore had no right to defend yourself. And either it will be dropped or the court will set a hearing, so then you will get a right to have the court decide on the order of protection. I hope that answers your question. Okay?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much, Karen.
All right, take care. I have a texter who asked, how long is a warrant good for? And I don't know the answer to the question. And usually warrants have on the face of them how long they're open. and how long they're valid, but they can expire. And if they expire, then you the prosecutor and the police have to go and get a new warrant. But without any having any context, I don't really know the answer to that question. Do we have any callers? Call me here. Who wants to do a legal news trivia question? You got some callers coming in, 981-7200, 981-7200. Either that or I'm going to make Ben answer the questions. I got a text this week. I want your opinion on the case of the two police officers who were hit by a train. That was a terrible tragedy. Remember what happened? There was a guy who found a gun, and he was shooting it off in the air, and the two police officers responded to that and didn't hear the train coming and were run over by a train. It was just very tragic. The guy who was shooting off the weapons was charged with weapons, you know, not having a license for the gun and unlawful use of a weapon, but he was not charged with murder, and the question from the texture was, why couldn't he be charged with murder? Because his crime resulted in police officers being killed. And the answer to that is that there has to be causation, and the causation cannot have any intervening factors, meaning if the guy shot in the air and the bullet came down and hit somebody, that would be a cause, and that could be some kind of murder, second-degree murder, or reckless homicide. But because there were so many intervening factors here, he shot the gun off, the police were summoned to come and investigate it, and as a result of coming there, they accidentally got hit by a train. The death was caused by that intervening factor, which was the train hitting them, not the crime of shooting off the gun. So I don't think there would be the proper causation to bring those charges, and I just don't think that that's going to happen. Okay, let's go to Ron. Ron from Naperville. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, good. All right, so Jerry's going to keep score here. I don't know where Jerry is, but if you get more right than wrong, you will get a Karen Conti show hat. Very valuable. Okay?
Okay.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay, this week, this book became the longest running on the number one spot on Amazon, the longest streak since 50 Shades of Grey. Can you give me the author and the title? And it's, I'm going to give you a hint. It's
Michelle Obama.
That's correct. Do you know the name of it?
Believing or
Becoming. I'm going to give you that.
Thank you.
Very good. All right. Okay, next question. This Hello Dolly star died this week at the age of 97.
Carol Channing.
That is correct. Carol Channing. She had an interesting career. She seemed like a very, very nice lady, very talented lady. All right. President Trump hosted the Clemson Tigers in the White House and served food from this restaurant.
I thought he had it from Wendy's and Burger King.
Ah, that's correct. That's correct. And I would have accepted either one of them. Okay. Now, this week was the 10th anniversary of Miracle on the Hudson. What was Miracle on the Hudson, and what was the name of the man who was responsible for it?
That was where they landed the plane, emergency landing of the plane, and the guy's captain, I saw the movie. I'm drawing it. It's like Huffy or Puffy.
I'm going to say, I'm going to buy a consonant, S, beginning with S.
Sully.
Good job. Exactly. That was 10 years ago this week. January 15, 2009, it was a flight from U.S. Airways. It took off, I believe, from New York, and it struck some geese. And the engine lost power, and he miraculously landed the plane, and all 155 people were rescued. So that was 10 years ago this week.
Yeah. In the movie, they portrayed it as they were trying to blame Sully, and I hope that wasn't true.
Oh, I didn't know that. How could he have been to blame for the geese?
So something he did somehow endangered the passengers, you know, and they had some quasi-trial, but I don't know how much of that was true.
Yeah, I thought he was an all-around hero. But anyway, it seemed to me that he did a very good job and landed in a way that didn't hurt anybody on the ground as well. Okay, this ex-president ordered pizza for his Secret Service detail, three pizzas for seven Secret Service
George
personnel.
George W. Bush.
That is correct. He said that he was grateful for the men and women who was working to keep him and his family safe. And he also mentioned that he thought it would be a great idea to end the impasse in Washington. And good old George Bush. I kind of miss him now. Anyway.
Yeah. Trump is actually making him look good.
I'm going to have to agree with you on that. Okay. This company, and I'm going to use words that are going to help you here. This company is facing sharp criticism for its warning against toxic masculinity. It's an ad that
Gillette.
That is correct. Very controversial ad. I don't know why it's so controversial. It's just saying that men shouldn't be overly masculine, and it didn't. I didn't think it was obnoxious to me.
I saw the mock commercials making fun of it. I never saw the original.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't offend me one way or the other. Anyway, this week in New York, a witness in the trial of drug kingpin El Chapo testified that El Chapo gave a $100 million bribe to who?
The president of Mexico, is it?
That is correct. The president of Mexico, Enrique Pena. The president initially wanted $250 million. You know what? We're all out of time, and you got them all, so you're going to get a Karen Conti hat. Stay online. Ben is going to get your address, and we're going to go for a break. Let me just tell you, if you wanted to send me an email with any questions you have, wgn@askkarenconti.com, 312-332-7800.